Hello and welcome to the Miko Bits Show, and I'm your host, Miko Bits. And today I have quite a special show for you. Today's show is actually about VR, virtual reality, as well as augmented reality and all of the things like that. So I have Tipitat, who is an expert in virtual reality. He's been in the space for quite a while, and it's really an honor to have him here on the show. So welcome to the Miko Bits Show, Tipitat.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to be here. I've been watching regularly and learning so much, so glad to finally be on it and excited to talk a little bit about what we're seeing in the virtual reality, augmented reality worlds and how it relates to the metaverse and all that kind of stuff. So,
good. I love this. So go ahead.
Give a quick intro, background, bio kind of.
Yeah. I'd love to get that. And then we'll go into a little bit.
So I'm general partner and co-founder of the Venture Reality Fund. It's a fund that I put together with my partner, Marco Ramirez. We've been doing this for over 6 years now. We're an early stage fund investing in seed to series A in VR, AR, AI startups that are part of the metaverse and building the metaverse. What's really interesting about us is, it's interesting. People think, oh, VR, it's going to just be gaming. And we've actually done just as many healthcare investments as we have done gaming investments. And this idea really came from this belief that VR, AR, AI technologies was going to be a revolution in computing. It was going to be the next phase, like the switch from mainframe to desktop and then desktop to mobile, that there's going to be this shift from mobile to spatial that would allow more people to benefit from computing technologies. And just like how the internet, the desktop and mobile evolution had their internet, we believe spatial needs their own internet, which we call the metaverse. And so we've been doing this for a while now. We've had some pretty big successes from Fund One, especially in the gaming, like the best known are gaming companies. So Rec Room, which is the first VR unicorn, software unicorn in the space, which is a huge kind of Roblox-like social VR experience where there's a lot of user-generated content where players are building experiences other players play. And then Beat Games, which makes Beat Saber, which is the most successful VR game of all time. It's one of those huge crazy examples of the Flappy Birds meets all of that, the Angry Birds, in terms of small indie studio that came out of nowhere from the Czech Republic and just created the monster that I think they've done over $300 million in revenue to date off of an initial less than $500K investment, and they're acquired by Meta and they're definitely the flagship title. I think they said that the Quest Store has done over $1 billion in revenue, and that Beat Saber probably counts for at least 100, if not 150 million of that.
I love it. And, I'm a Beat Saber guy, $100 bills. I'm cutting all them cubes, so I, nice. I definitely am a fan. It's wonderful. So I guess, what are your kind of earliest recollections of the metaverse or VR or anything related? How did you kind of get into this? And, how did this evolve for you?
I mean, I'm definitely, I grew up a gamer, earliest memories are of, playing the Atari and just trying all those different things and growing up with all of the different consoles and, skipping school to play games at the arcade, all of that. And what's been interesting to see it evolve over time, right, is this idea that, when games first started, they were super simplistic. And now if you look at the visual fidelity, the storytelling, everything about it, if we look at just numbers and revenue, time spent, gaming is now the biggest entertainment, activity in the world. So gamers really have taken over, more so than sports, more so than movies, more so than music. And it's influence in culture. We could see what Fortnite was doing, has just been nonstop. And now we look at something like Roblox. It's interesting, right? We think about World of Warcraft, and we thought, oh my god, at that time it was so big, and that was one of the best examples of a MMO and this idea of living in a virtual world, right? And it at its peak had 10 million MAU, right? And then or we'll talk about Second Life, which got so much hype in terms of being a very early metaverse, social, and at its peak it was 1 million MAU, right? And people are oh my god, it's gonna happen, it's so crazy. But then they all kind of topped out, or they peaked at that. Now we look at these new virtual online worlds, and Roblox, they have 50 million DAU, daily active users. right? And the order of magnitude that is. And the thought, too, of like, you know, I grew up the Nintendo, Sony, you know, PlayStation generation, and now, you know, I'm still obsessed with virtual world. But the kids today that are growing up in Roblox, right? Like, imagine the world that they want to be in, what the internet wants to be, or what, you know, how they want to interact with the digital world and the digital self, right? Like, they're going to have such a much more sophisticated understanding of these things that we are barely imagining today.
I think one of the things that's really fundamentally happening that I'm super excited about is actually this kind of super long story arc of what I call the revenge of the nerds, right? Which is that, like, I think when you and I were growing up, like, you know, we'd go to the arcade or whatever, you know, and there are other kids going, you know, but, like, you know, having, like, a personal computer at home and, like, being a computer nerd, you know, in a way, like, the story arc has gotten really complete, right? In the sense that, like, when you think about what's happened with the metaverse, you think about, like, Ready Player One, and you think about, like, gamer culture, right? Like, the culture has really become pretty central, and I think that's a big part of it.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's also too, like, my parents were like, what are you doing? Waste your time playing these video games. They'll never amount to anything, right? Like, that was always, like, the common, like, oh my God, you're gonna waste your... And now it's like, okay, well, for a while it was like, oh, well, you can get a career making video games, and that would be a big thing. But now, in the past, like, you know, 10 years, you can make a career playing video games, right? And being a part of it, and not necessarily having to be a developer. You can be, you know, a creator in worlds like, you know, Roblox, or, you know, you can be a streamer, or you can be a esports athlete, like, and now, you know, play to earn. There's all these different opportunities to be like, oh yeah, I can make a living in the digital world playing games, being a part of this game culture that I love, right?
Yeah, and let's go all the way back. Like, what are your kind of top three personal influences, you know, top three games kind of arcade generation, right? So if you go all the way back, like, you know, what were the ones that really kind of opened this up for you?
I mean, definitely a combination of so many, like, you know, along the paths, but I would say, like, I think the best example for me is still Street Fighter, in terms of, like, you know, that was the game where, you know, social bonding, going to the arcades, you know, competition, but also, like, this idea of, like, mastery of a game, where it's, like, easy to play but then hard to master, but that you could really put in time, and it felt like, you know, you're gonna get, like, a black belt in playing Street Fighter because it was so complicated, and once you, like, do the moves. But
then what was your main?
I mostly Ryu. Sometimes I would use Guile. Like, you know, switch between the two. But what's funny about it was also the first game that when you played it, it felt really good. It, like, you get into this kind of flow state. And it's almost like playing the piano, where you have this, like, mastery, like, the way the hands, like, the gesture movements. I don't, just something about it became magical. Like, pulling off that combo, right? It felt like, I don't know, just something otherworldly, right, with your hands. And it just felt right. And I think that was, like, the first weird experience I had where I was like, oh, it's more than just pressing buttons. It's like playing an instrument, right? Like, it just felt amazing in that way. I don't know if you can understand what I'm saying, but yeah, pulling off that combo or pulling off a good combo, it just feels like, yeah, like, you put in the work, you master it, it's so rewarding. And I guess it's really a dopamine hit or whatever, but it's just that kind of rewarding for investing the time in gameplay. It was very satisfying. And then adding that strategy, I almost felt like it was like sped up real-time chess in terms of the strategy that you'd have to use. And it was just so cool to see all of that kind of come together in this way. So who did you use? Who was your main?
Yeah, I was actually a Chun-Li. So that was, I always liked the quick kicks. I thought that was fun. And for whatever reason, I always liked to play, like, you know, eccentric characters. Like, in World of Warcraft, I was maining a Gnome Warlock, but it was a female Gnome Warlock, right?
Awesome.
It was so funny because in the early parts of the game, people would be, like, surprised that the player was male, you know, and I would always have to say, remind them, like, I'm not actually a gnome either in real life, you know, and, like, you know, so people for some reason found that to be odd. But for me, gaming was always about trying something different, right? Like if you get to, you have to be yourself in life. So why wouldn't you try to be something else, you know, just for fun, just to see what happens?
No, absolutely. I mean, I think that's the thing about even just like storytelling and music and like all these things, it's like let you experience things that you wouldn't otherwise experience, right? And so I love that, yeah, that you want to try different identities or do different things. And it's like, yeah, like the one thing, right, in life is, you know, we have only a finite amount of time. We can only live one lifetime. But through games or movies, we get to experience so many other lifetimes, right? Like, be a hero, be a warrior, be a, you know, gnome, yeah. priestess.
Yeah, I'm super excited to hear you touching some of these themes, right? Because one of the things I've been thinking a lot about is sort of the blockchain as a history recording device, right? And in a sense, this idea that you have limited time is almost embodied by something like the concept of time sovereignty, right? Which appeared in Axie Infinity, right? So people mm-hmm. who own their time are now investing their time, right? And the investment yeah. of their time is being rewarded, right? So to me, the idea of time as a sovereign creator economy, like a currency, is pretty interesting and novel. But I guess for me, one of the things I'd love to get from you is sort of, you know, we keep hearing rumblings about things like Cambria, like we keep hearing things about kind of upcoming VR. And I think BlackRock said that this would be the year of VR. So I'm curious, like, you know, what's coming down the pike and, you know, what should we be looking forward to?
I mean, I would say definitely the biggest change was last year when the Quest 2 really had that, like, you know, right form factor of, I mean, you know, for a long time, we're like, what is VR? Is VR, you know, Google Glass? You know, can you just put it in your phone and have some, like, you know, vision thing and, like, look around? Or, you know, is it 360 movies? Like, what is VR? And I would say, like, you know, when we think about what works in VR, what's actually sticky, what actually creates where you have good retention, where users, players want to play it, stick around with it and continue to use it, but also more importantly, when they want to spend money on experiences, it really came down to VR needed to be, you know, the headset with full 6 degrees of freedom tracking, so complete head and movement tracking, so not just rotation, but X, Y, Z, and also hand track controllers, gesture controllers. And what this taught us was, you know, it wasn't just seeing the virtual world, but it was interacting with it in a natural way, right? Like when you see, you know, a virtual ball, you want to just grab it and throw it. You don't want to, like, press a button and then press another button and then swing your, you know, trigger. Like, no, you just wanted to grab it like you would physically move it. And that, I think, is that allowing the digital world to feel more natural is the magic of VR, right? Like the full immersion of the environment, but also of the objects within that world. And so getting better VR headsets that allow you to do that. The Quest was that first one to do it in a, you know, you don't need a tethered PC, you don't need sensors, it was all portable package, and at a really affordable price point. And so now that that's out there, it's been hugely successful, you know, 10 million units, you know, over $1 billion in the App Store, you know, hundreds of companies making millions of dollars and more. You know, and like I said, too, a top performing company can make up to 100 million, even on just 10 million install base. But now what we're talking about, what's coming next. So, you know, I think definitely getting a better form factor, I think that's going to be huge. But I think, you know, other things people are talking about are really pass-through AR. This idea is like, you know, you still have the screens in front of your face, but then you have two cameras mounted in front and it lets you see the real world. So you can do better blending between the real and the virtual. And with the Quest, you kind of have this art already. They have, like, you know, the black and white mode when you're setting up the screen. And it's kind of janky. It's more like a developer debug system. And it's just important to help, you know, the camera understand or the computer understand what's going on. But now to do it so that it is in full color, high quality, low latency, so that it feels good for the user, I think that's the big, you know, hopeful upgrade that we expect in Cambria, which is kind of like the Quest Pro or the, you know, Quest 3 Plus or whatever people want to call it, but that hopefully should come out this year. But then what's interesting too is, you know, there's still a lot of other different innovations that are being worked on. So Sony announces their PlayStation VR 2. And, you know, there's a whole bunch of different, you know, higher visual fidelity, eye tracking, you know, better haptics on the controllers. The controllers feel a lot more like what Valve has been doing with Index controllers. So a better sense of touch and hand feel with the controllers. And so, you know, I think we're seeing a whole bunch of different, you know, ways to kind of improve and upgrade the experience. And then the other thing, too, that's even just for the Quest, but it looks like a software upgrade, is that there's been more talk about better body tracking in the Quest. And so they recently acquired a company called Supernatural, which was a fitness game. And then they, Chris Milk, their CEO, founder, he showed off a little video where people were doing, and if you're familiar with it, it's similar to Beat Saber. You have like bats, you know, like hitting balls. But then they showed this
thing. Yeah, I did that this morning.
Nice. They're doing leg lifts, and they're showing like, oh, it was tracking your knees and when your knees were going up. And so now if it's tracking more of the body, potentially the legs, and I'm not sure if that's all just within the camera or if they're doing something else where maybe you have to set up, you know, your phone to like observe you and track you there. But definitely this idea of like getting more of your body into the virtual space is going to be huge. Yeah, we've seen some interesting experiments with like more face tracking. So when you're in these social experiences, it feels more like your authentic you know, face when you're expressing and emoting with other people. And what else? I mean, yeah, there's still a ton of innovation. But honestly, the other one I wanted to really talk about too was, it's weird when a lot of people are like, oh, VR, you know, why does VR look like VR has to look, or why are these experiences don't look as high fidelity as, you know, what we see on an Xbox or a PlayStation? I mean, part of it is it's hard because you have to do double the rendering, one for each eye. But a big part of it too is right now the most popular VR platform, the Quest, is really built on mobile hardware, right? So you're like, you know, you're asking a cell phone to perform as well as an Xbox or a PlayStation 5. And it's like, well, that's just tough to do. But then, you know, for the people that are on PC VR, you know, they've been having these amazing AAA quality experiences like Half-Life Alyx. I don't know if you've gotten to play it, but it is like a game from
the
future.
It's on my list.
It's amazing. I would highly prioritize it. It's just amazing. And now there's companies that are working with cloud streaming where the latency can be low enough that you can actually have a Quest stream from a server and have it, you know, interact. And so you have the high-end visual fidelity experiences of PC gaming and playing a Half-Life Alyx, but in a wired tetherless headset or a wireless tetherless headset. And I think that's going to be powerful too, right? Where you're like, oh my gosh, the quality, the visual fidelity of the experiences, you know, the interaction fidelity too, the physics engines, all of that will get a major upgrade when you're no longer having to be powered by, you know, a chip inside a headset, but can be, you know, powered by the fastest GPUs available. And so I think that's going to really unlock a lot of really interesting experiences and use cases for a lot more people that haven't had access to it yet. I think,
yeah.
I wanted to plug Pluto. I think Pluto VR is one of the first to really have a cloud solution that you can, I think you download it on SideQuest, and if you want to start experimenting it with it. I think, you know, there's still some infrastructure stuff that needs to be done to get it out to more of the people. But already in certain cities, certain areas, I think you can have a pretty good quality experience with it. And especially if you are less motion sensitive prone.
Yeah. I tend to get a little seasick, you know, especially if it's sort of a very kind of a more like combat vibe, you know, like that kind of makes me queasy. You know, I tend to like things like rhythm. You know, I like Beat Saber, I like Supernatural, you know, I like kind of big body motion and rhythm. Like I think that kind of suits me really well. I can tolerate quite a lot of that.
Yeah, I think, you know, for a lot of people that are still like, oh, you know, VR makes me sick or uncomfortable, you know, it's really just the types of experiences that you do. So finding the ones where the world, you don't use a joystick to move and the world moves and you kind of stay in place and things come to you, or you're in a static area and you're moving around yourself, those tend to be a lot more comfortable. And I tell people too, it's like, even with TVs, right? Remember when like Pokemon made a whole bunch of people sick and had seizures, right? Like it's, now, I think VR is at that point where you can design it right, where you won't get people sick, and it's less and less of an issue. And it's not just a technology, it's more of a design issue now. It's really interesting.
Yeah, it is amazing. I mean, so in terms of like your vision for the future of VR, like, you know, where obviously we're going to see incredible increases in fidelity, and we're, you know, we're definitely going to see a lot of AR things happening. Like, you know, where do you see this going?
You know, I think a lot of people ask me like, yeah, like what's the tipping point? Or, you know, and I think for gaming, we're kind of already there, right? Like once you get to 10 million, once you get to a billion in revenue, it's like, okay, this has already kind of proven itself as a gaming, you know, as a viable gaming platform. But I think, you know, again, for me, the vision of VR and AR has always been bigger, right? And I think this idea of productivity, and what does it mean to, you know, create, have a living, do things in VR that you couldn't do in real life. And right now, on the enterprise side, we see a lot of training applications, right? People are either training, you know, for surgery, or Walmart's been training millions of people using VR technology. But I think what's really interesting is when people are actually doing work in VR. And so right now, you know, we look at who are the people doing the work in VR. It's really like car manufacturers, shoe designers. They're actually using VR tools, and it's a much better streamlined workflow. They're doing collaborative reviews. And it's very clear that designing and creating in 3D objects is better using VR and AR tools, right? It's easier to understand, more, it makes it more accessible, people can work faster, so it's a better experience. Now, people are like, well, how many 3D things are there? You know, of course, physical products, you know, environments like architecture, but then if you think about it, the 3D worlds of video games, right? That's the 3D that needs a lot more designing and a lot more help designing. And especially as we talk about the metaverse, right? The explosion for 3D content is going to be so huge. And VR, AR are the right tools, not just to immerse yourself and view it, but actually to create and build it. And I think that's what's going to be really fun. Like, one way I think about it right now, right? Like, how many people are 3D designers? Very small part of the world, right? And it's because doing 3D design, it's really like doing CAD or drafting and, you know, using your mouse, clicking on polygon. It's very obtuse, right? It's not super easy for everyone to do. But what's great about VR, you know, if you ever used any of the VR art tools like Tilt Brush, right, or Medium, it's much more like playing with Legos or sculpting. And so if designing felt more tangible, more like the real world, almost anyone could then do it, right?
Yeah, I like this. Actually, Will Robinson from DeFi Alliance, from the Alliance, is coming on a little bit later on the Miko Bits show. And like one of the things he's been talking about is what he calls Playber. Right. And Playber is like labor, only you're playing. Right. And what is that about? Like, in a sense, what's happening right now is that the community of play to earn is kind of responding to this kind of feeling about sustainability. Right. And so we're really talking about things like economic input. Right. Which is like who's creating value using their time. Right. Mm-hmm. And so the idea of something like a Roblox is kind of economically built on a lot of people just building and creating experiences for other players, right? So I think that becomes much more sustainable when people are creating.
Absolutely. I mean, I think fundamentally the idea of like user-generated content, right? Of enabling, you know, 3D worlds, 3D experiences, 3D objects to be built not by, you know, studio or developers, but, you know, individuals and creators, I think is really powerful and a shift. And what I think about is so interesting about it too is like, you know, we think about today and what we see with today is like, yeah, the 2D internet, right? Like everyone's like, oh, okay, well, there are creators. They create social media. They create, you know, the influencers, the YouTubers, right? Like they create media and then they monetize it through advertising. But the one thing that we've learned is that advertising model is super toxic or creates extreme toxicity, right? It encourages or rewards bad behavior like invasion of privacy or clickbait or, you know, like anger-driven content, right? Because that gets the most engagement, right?
And lies.
And that's bad, right? But what's interesting, you know, like when we switch to the metaverse creator economy and it's more based on user-generated content and people are selling, you know, 3D objects or gameplay experiences, games essentially, right? Then I think, you know, you're monetizing directly to the consumers. It's not mediated through a advertising exchange that promotes toxic behavior. And so I think it could be a huge benefit, right, for how we think about monetizing digital economies and, you know, how creators get paid and what does it mean to be a creator. And so I'm really excited for that idea. I think that's going to be a lot more valuable in the long run. And what I think is really interesting too is this, we're already seeing examples of this, right? On Roblox, there's already, you know, kids are not just paying for their college tuition, they're actually paying off their parents' mortgage with their earnings that they made in Robux. And I think Roblox last year just announced that they had done over, was it $500 million in terms of revenue in the Roblox player economy? And you're like, yeah, that's pretty awesome.
Yeah, you know, one of the things this makes me think a lot about is it makes me think about this kind of idea of like a sort of almost like a digital supply chain kind of concept, right? In the sense that, like, for example, like 3D modeling is sort of a skill, right? But it's a different skill from like storytelling, you know, it's a different skill from something like being an entertaining streamer. It's a different skill, you know, so there's a bunch of different skills, right? In terms of like making an interaction model or making game design rules and things, you know? And so like, it feels like there will increasingly be these kinds of like value chains, you know, where people will create an object and then they'll just put the objects into wherever and then the other people will carry the ball, right?
Yeah. I mean, the way I think about it too, there are going to be all sorts of jobs that we don't know now that will be created, right? But I think that idea of being like an actor, like an interactive actor or character or like a host for like you know, an MMO quest in a VR MMO, right? Like, I think those things are going to be like a dungeon master, or where someone's acting out the voices of the NPCs and, you know, doing all sorts of things, right? I think there's going to be so many different opportunities that we can barely even imagine today, right? And I'm excited for that.
I love the idea of like actors, right? Because in a way, like the goal to me, like we were talking at YGG about the future of work, right? And in a way, like there was a very play to earn theme around it, right? But to me, I really wanted to extend it further into what I was talking about in respect to this idea of working for the delight of your community or tribe, mm-hmm. right? So in a sense, when you think about this idea of UGC, you think about actors, right? So it's like, oh, I'm an actor. And it's like, what does that mean? Well, it means that like something is tracking my face and I'm able to kind of appear in any kind of a scene, right? And you know, what's happening to me is I'm getting all the cues on my like heads up display, right? And it's kind of like, here's what's happening, you know, and so here's how you're supposed to act, you know? And so like people can come in and like play their part and like do a bang up job, right? And maybe earn.
Yeah.
Maybe act, I mean, act to earn.
Honestly too, like when you see what's going on in, online virtual communities, like in VR chat, right? A lot of it is people are wearing the skins of their favorite character and acting out and performing and interacting and doing this kind of like stand-up improv cosplay with other folks, and it's cool, and it's just like, yeah, this is the kind of behavior that's exciting and fun and hopefully will be, you know, rewarded and monetized in meaningful ways. But you know, it's really interesting. The way I think about it is like, you know, UGC and play to earn, from what I see. So UGC is really empowering your player base to become your developers, right? To create more content for other players to play, right? And then the way I look at play to earn, right? It's like, okay, well, you're incentivizing your players to play against other players. And so you're trying to, like, you're almost mechanical turking the NPCs, right? Or the enemy characters and saying, okay, well, now you're going to play against another person. You're going to battle them. But instead of us having just AI do it, now we're going to just pay people in, you know, virtual currency, smooth love potion or whatever to kind of make that happen.
Yes.
But, you know, I'm kind of curious about your take, though, with, you know, things kind of falling apart with the Axie economy and all this kind of stuff.
Yep.
I mean, yeah, it was like 2 months ago, oh my God, this is it. This is the future. And now, as the biggest, brightest example of it is, I'm not saying they're going to crash and burn, but are having a very difficult time really showing the longevity of this model.
Yeah.
Like, what do you see? Is it taking the learnings of this and then someone will create something better? What are the big takeaways, especially in this inflection point?
Yeah, so I love the comment. I was on a wonderful sort of panel with Lars Doucette, who's sort of one of the principal critics of Axie Infinity, you know, and he did the research on this. It was a very, very interesting, you know, and it was Nico's podcast with Bitcraft, so you know you can find it. But to me, like, I'm really interested in expanding the palette in the way that you've been describing, right? Because what has happened with Axie is that there are really two primary economic actors, right? There's the sort of time investor who is a first class player in the Axie world, right? And then there's a money investor. And the thing that's amazing is that the money investor, who's the pillar of the economic model, is actually a second class player. How do I assert that the money investor is a second class player, right? Because all of the designed screens are designed for the time investor. Now, I respect the time investor. You know, YGG is a guild made up of time investors, you know, so I definitely understand the power of this concept of a time investor, right? But I you know, we have seen like the rise of people like Meta Kovan, you know, the first billionaire time investor, you know, someone who has started with only time and eventually got lots of money, right? But I would say that, like, to me, what I see is that you're talking about almost like what I would call 1.5 economic actors, right? So what I mean by 1.5 is it's a game that has time investors, which is kind of an amazing novelty, but then a half of a player in the monetary player, right? Like, what if the monetary player had a first-class interface, right? What if the monetary player was, you know, because if you look at something like Axie.management, right, there's a full, almost like fantasy football-like way to manage Axie players, right? Like, that's a first-class gamification, right? Yeah, uh-huh. So that's just one of two. Like, what about ideas like celebrities coming into the game, right? Like Marshmello and Fortnite having a first-class interface. And what about like esports? That's a like skill player that has a first-class interface. And what you're pointing out is that there could be object crafters, there could be dungeon masters, there could be actors, there could be streamers, there could be, right? So to me, it's an entertainment medium, mm-hmm. right? And so I think what I'm saying is I'm saying that like if everyone is playing only to earn,
yeah.
Then when the earnings start to decrease, then they will stop playing immediately, right? And so the thing that I think is important becomes sort of play and earn, right? And also this kind of injection of the ability for more recognition of the value of entertainment, right? Mm-hmm. So if people are you know, so the thing that's amazing about what you're saying about UGC and community is exciting to me, right? Because if an actor comes in and plays a part and then you tip them or you get, or somehow they earn because they were, did an awesome job and they were so fun, right? Like that's really amazing because it's an economic recognition of entertainment value, right? And so that to me is how you make this thing really deeply sustainable, right? Is that you work not just for a wage, mm-hmm. but you work for the delight of your community. That's what you work for. And by the way, if you do that, that scales like crazy. And what I mean by it scales like crazy is that like if you're able to insanely delight someone, the value of that is pretty uncapped. Like, yeah. You know, like and I think that's, there are very severe limits in how insanely delighting you can be in Axie. I mean, I would say that maximally someone like Jiho could take like a legendary Axie and give it to someone for free, you know, so that's about as delighting as you could possibly be.
Yeah. But of course, too, right? They're investing a lot. There's going to be a lot of big changes to Axie and it's going to evolve.
Yeah. Absolutely. They like, just did a big update that kind of caused SLP to go up by like 200-300%. So, you know, I think they're not, you know, they're definitely making a comeback, and I think we're going to see more games on top of Ronin. So, you know, I definitely wouldn't count Axie out. You know?
Yeah. And I think, yeah, what you're saying too, where I like that idea of, yeah, it can't just be play to earn, right? Like, you have to have all the different kind of groups within that. And so it's going to be a blending of the different kind of economic models and player models, right? And you have to attract all of that to really make it successful and make it work.
I mean, I think this, right, which is that the history of gaming has been love and money, right? Mm-hmm. Love and money, right? And the thing that's always been the fear is kind of love of money, right? Mm-hmm. And when you look at the enemy in Ready Player One, you know, it's Nolan Sorrento who is kind of represents the suits and the greed, right? Yeah. And so in a sense, like, you know, there has to be love, and there has to be, and you know, to me, one of the things that's, it is amazing is the Axie community does have like a core and it does have a center, and like they're pets, like those are pets, right? So people do have affinity, they have affection, the art design is quite beautiful, you know, the game is actually quite entertaining, you know, relative to what people say, you know, so there is a heart there, you know, and I think that, you know, so I'm not saying that it's only, people are only there grinding out money, you know, but it's a large motivation. And I think we can definitely expand and, you know, take that incredibly inspiring story and go even bigger.
Yeah. It's funny when you mention like play and this idea, yeah, and even just the concept of play to earn, right? There's this famous psychological study. I don't know if you've heard about it, but it was like a psychologist paid or their kids that were drawing two groups, right? Like doing, you know, kindergartners doing drawing, right? And so they split up two groups. And so the one group, they actually paid them a penny for every drawing. And productivity actually went down in that group over the long term. Like, it spiked up, and then it crashed. Because it came from being a, hey, this is something I do for fun and for love, or just enjoyment, to, okay, now this is just labor and a grind, and it's interesting. And I think, yeah, finding that balance, right, and being able to, like, attract both sides of that, I think is going to be valuable.
It makes me wonder how the experiment would go, and this is unmeasurable, right, which is that if they kind of created rituals around sort of delight, right, so that created the idea of, like, some kind of, maybe it's like show and tell, like maybe the kid gets to, like, show their art and then, like, everybody claps or something, you know, like, so if you create some kind of structure around the concept of delight, right, because I really think delight is underappreciated, right, because in a sense, like, we should all strive to delight our communities, our friends, our family members, our players, our users, like, whoever we're working for, you know, like, that should be our, you know, passion and goal.
No, absolutely. I think it's interesting too, where, you know, I think part of this also shows the evolution of gaming as it matures as a medium, right? Whereas before it was like this, like, kind of weird pastime, and, you know, people looked down on it, and it was just, oh, something to do to pass time, to, like, you know, oh, okay. And then eventually it became more sophisticated, became richer and deeper and more meaningful. And then, you know, people started to understand, okay, there could be value and mastery of it, or that it could provide, you know, really rich, you know, moving, evocative experiences, and, you know, talk about the condition, you know, human condition, as well as any, you know, book or any film, right? And so now we've kind of reached this maturity in terms of intellectually how we accept gaming. But then I think also too, that also goes with how big gaming has become, and it changes, like, the monetization behaviors around it. And yeah, we saw the shift from games from arcades to games in the home, and, you know, games as packaged goods, to then social game and mobile games, really bringing this idea of free to play and this idea of, you know, like, different monetization models that, again, were fought against. And I definitely remember, you know, when mobile games first started happening, there were a lot of, like, you know, traditional game snobs are like, oh, mobile games aren't real games. And, like, oh, those things are just, you know, slot machines or just click. And some are not, like, super sophisticated in it. But it's just like, give it time to grow, and it'll take, you know, some of the best characteristics of everything. And now some of these, you know, mobile games are super sophisticated and super fantastic. Or you can play, you know, the biggest games like Fortnite or in Roblox on mobile as well as on PC. And they're still very good experiences on both. And I think, you know, blockchain gaming is also kind of seeing that thing, whereas first it was kind of looked down upon, and not, and now it's found a new potential monetization model, and that's kind of, you know, being challenged. But I think, again, more smart people working on it, more people get comfortable with it, I think that we're going to see a lot more very fast, like, maturing and growing in this sector, and we're going to see a lot more sophisticated and really compelling game experiences that will bring a lot of joy to people, as well as hopeful financial success.
So when you talk about that, I mean, you know, we are already seeing indications, like, for example, like, Microsoft is suggesting that, like, World of Warcraft will now be kind of coming cross-platform into mobile, you know. So I think that we are seeing this. I guess one thing I'd love to kind of get from you is, like, how does VR kind of factor into the future of kind of more like a transmedia mindset, right? Because it feels like VR is just a medium. So yeah. I'm, you know, is it the be-all, end-all? Is it the metaverse, or is there something bigger?
I think it's harder to get bigger than the metaverse, right? If you think about, like, I guess this will go back to, like, I'll take a little sideways. And we've talked about the metaverse, but we haven't properly defined it. And, everyone has their kind of different take on it. But the way I view the metaverse, I think it really is that, how do you live a complete digital life, right? How do you combine the three main things that we do in life, which is, you know, socialize, like, living life, hanging out with friends, meeting new people, then also playing, entertaining ourselves, yeah, playing video games. And then the last one, make a living, work. When you combine all three of those in that, then that's, to me, a proper metaverse, right? And then when you make that accessible to anyone and everyone, that's when it's the biggest opportunity the metaverse can be. And so, you know, I think you make a strong argument that you know, Roblox is a very early example, because it can do all three things, right? There's, of course, the games, But honestly, a lot of people use those games to kind of hang out with their friends, and they're not actively like playing the game to win, but just using it to socialize. And then there's concerts you can do, and, you know, fashion shows you can attend in Roblox and things like that, right? So that idea of like socialize, gaming, and then we talked about the UGC part, making a living. So all of that comes together in Roblox. But now, how do you make it more accessible to more people, right? And I think fundamentally, and this is where VR, AR really shine, is that, you know, some people still don't get super immersed in a 2D screen. And more importantly, some people don't get have a hard time either using a game controller or even a touchscreen to navigate and control 3D worlds, right?
Got it, yeah.
And so if now the real world, everything you learned about how to interact in the real world was how you played the games in the metaverse, then everyone would do it, right?
Yeah. I like this. I mean, if you define it this way, then in a sense, like, it comes back to what you were talking about earlier that I think of more like a supply chain, right? Which is that it could be that a 3D designer is using a headset to design something for a player that's sitting in mobile. Yeah. Or it may be that there are players who are, it may be that a PC user is using some kind of desktop CAD system and they're kind of like importing, you know, scanned models that are now being used in both 2D and 3D. Or, you know, so like what I'm saying is like it, the metaverse becomes much more meta, right? Yeah. So in a sense, like you're really talking about sort of like this objective that everybody is kind of living and playing and working, you know, within this kind of like transmedia digital realm.
Yeah. I mean, one way you think about, right, like democratizing 3D creation, right, is, okay, right now, I think the percentage of Roblox, you know, creators to players is very small. It's, I think, 5 to 7%, right, of their player base actually creates, right? And I would argue that it's because it feels like CAD and, you know, using your mouse to create 3D objects, and like, it's hard to be a 3D professional. Think about this, you know, with VR interfaces, right? It feels like you're playing with Legos. Now assembling a level feels like you're just putting together your Lego playset. And that's something almost everyone can do, right? And so now anyone that could be a Lego builder is now making 3D worlds or 3D objects in this world, right? And that kind of levels the playing field and allows everyone to do it. I kind of think about it this way too, right? Like when we think about desktop computers, and how they revolutionized graphic, 2D graphic design, right? Before desktop computers, before Adobe, Creative Suite, and Microsoft Word, and all that, and PowerPoint, right? Like very few people were graphic designers, knew about fonts. When you had to like get an Exacto and you had to like cut out each font and like typeset it, like very few people did that work. But now, because the tools became so easy, everyone knows what a font is. Everyone lives in PowerPoint. Everyone knows how to design all this kind of stuff. And in that same way, I think, AR, VR tools will allow 3D design, that same kind of ubiquity that, PC computers did for 2D design.
That is fascinating. I mean, one of the things that it makes me think, though, is it makes me think about kind of high fidelity tool chain, right? Because one of the things that's so intriguing to me is like, in a sense, there are like these geniuses of kind of 3D modeling, who are able to take stuff like Blender and like make monsters and do, so it's sort of like really head exploding what they're able to do with the tool chain. But like, what if increasingly there's sort of environmental awareness coming from our devices, right? Like if you look at the inclusion of things like LiDAR into the kind of iPhone, like AR kit and this kind of like sort of world awareness, right? It feels like increasingly the ability to sort of scan things into the 3D worlds becomes sort of an easier route, So maybe what happens is that like modelers could potentially carve things in wax and then just scan them in, right? Or there might be like media that is more intuitive to work with, because I just feel like
the digital interfaces make it feel like you're carving it out of wax or clay already, but gives you the undo button and all the benefits of the digital tool set, so it's actually going to be better. But then I think the next step beyond that, though, is AI, right, and synthetic media, and just being like, I don't know if you've seen like NVIDIA with their like Gauguin tool. It's really cool. But, you just, like, sloppily apply some paint and color, but it knows green should be grass, brown should be, dirt, and then it will create a beautiful scenery for you. But yeah, I've also seen startups pitch me this idea. You know, you just tell it. You're like, I want a scene with dancing penguins on top of a burning volcano. And then the AI will draw you their best interpretation of that.
Oh, yeah. That stuff gets really, really exciting, right? Yeah. Because when you talk about things like storytelling, you know, and storytelling media, yeah. right, then people can really move much faster, you know? So if you're like a dungeon master, you can just start kind of describing a scene, and the scene can start, AIs can start taking care of what it looks like, you know. And obviously there's lots of fantasy versions of this where the person's narrating a scene and the scene starts spilling out, and then the narrator's like, no, not like that, mm-hmm. you know, and then the scene kind of gets erased, and you know, so yeah, like there's yeah, a lot yeah, of yeah. like movie fantasy sequences that kind of go like that, right? Yep. And that feels very real to me. I mean, one of the things that I see happening with AR technology or with AI technology is that things like our cameras are becoming very opinionated, right? So sure. in a sense, like, you know, cameras are making decisions about like what you're trying to do, right? And mm-hmm. The camera's basically being like, yeah, you screwed up that shot, but that's okay, right? Like, I know the shot you were trying to get, and I'm able to kind of make it look like you got the shot that you wanted, you know? So for example, like cameras do things like take a bunch of images, and then it'll notice that the person's blinking in some of them, and it'll just throw those out, you know? So it's sort of like, wow, like it's amazing, you know, what, there's a crazy feature where you can take a picture of a group of people and it'll composite to make sure nobody's blinked.
That's right? Awesome.
And so it'll just composite all the faces so that everyone's eyes are open, even though one of them's blinking, you know? So it's that kind of stuff is just crazy. Like that, you know, so I think AIs are definitely going to be exceedingly dominant in this kind of creation process. And I do think that they're going to be opinionated, right? They're going to be like, oh yeah. You want it like this. You definitely don't want that.
Yeah, no, and definitely too, like in the creation process, but also like leveling up in terms of like managing these economies and doing all sorts of different things behind the scenes, but also for like, you know, characters. I don't know if you saw, there's this great like GPT-3 of a powered AI chatbot like character in a game. And it was funny, it was like in, I forget the name of the experience now, I want to say it's Modbox. And you know, it was, and that had a voice synthesis by a company called Replica Studios, and it was cool. You walk up to this in this game, it's a hot dog vendor, and you start asking him about his life, and he'll just tell you, complain about his wife or this and that, what City Hall's up to, and you're just like, what? Like, this is crazy. But it gives you this like rich narrative world that, you know, goes beyond like the canned responses that we're used to playing, you know, RPGs in the past. And so I think that idea of having the digital world behave more naturally, I think AI is going to empower a lot of that, and it's going to make it a much more seamless, like richer experience for us all around. And I'm looking forward to those kinds of things.
I like that. I'm super excited. You know, these are all like really frontier ideas, and you know, I think it's really going to make a huge difference to how entertaining, exciting, fun our lives can be. So really appreciate you jumping on the show.
No, really enjoyed this. And again, thanks so much for having me, and looking forward to more conversations in the future.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, Tupatat. Thank you very much.
Thank you.